I'm Julie Burstein here in for Leonard Lopate. For the last few years, the website The Rumpus has featured an advice column called Dear Sugar. Now, if you're wondering what fork to use for your salad, what's a good opening line to use, or whether you should ask for a discount from your dentist if you pay cash, sugar is probably not the advice column for you. But if you're hoping for a generous and comforting voice on the complicated messes we all find ourselves in at times, Sugar's wisdom can help. Sugar is the writer Cheryl Strayed, and her columns have been collected and released as a book entitled Tiny Beautiful Things, which is published by Vintage. And Cheryl is also the author of the best-selling memoir Wild, in which she described her three-month journey on the Pacific Crest Trail after her mother's death. I'm so glad to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Was it hard to begin offering advice to people?
It was incredibly hard. I really questioned myself at the outset. Who was I to give advice? Who was anyone to give advice was a question I asked. I had never thought to do that before in any kind of professional capacity. And I was really not that familiar with the advice column form. But I did it because it seemed interesting to me. And I've always been a writer and a person who followed my curiosity. It's always led me good places. And I thought, what better writing prompt than real people's problems and secrets and struggles? And so I just trusted my gut. I took my own advice. As Sugar, I tell people often to trust their gut. And I did that with this column.
To begin with, you were anonymous. Did that offer you a freedom that you might not have had if you were answering these questions as Cheryl?
You know, it didn't. And that sounds a little counterintuitive. But right at the outset, I knew that I wanted to try this anonymous thing. I wanted to see what anonymity gave me as a writer, but I always knew that someday I would have my name on it, that I would reveal my identity. So I wrote it with the consciousness of my name being on it. Readers experienced it differently. I think at first, because I do in my writing so often really go to the dark places and tell some of the rawest truths about my own life, people sort of thought, well, maybe this was a mask, that this anonymity allowed me to do that. But in fact, I do that as Cheryl Strayed, too, in my other writing. And so it was really just, another piece of what I was doing in my work, and I knew my name would be on it someday.
As in your own life, do you seek advice? I know you talk a lot about trusting your gut. It sounds like you listen to yourself a lot. Are you someone who goes to other people for advice as well?
Every day, every day. I don't think that there's a day that passes that I don't in some way seek counsel from my husband, who is really my best friend and confidant, and my dear friends. And there are many different people in my life I turn to for different things. And so I think that that's really part of life. And that was one of the ways that I was able, I guess, to say, okay, I can write this column, because I realized that we're giving each other advice all the time.
As Sugar, you read all of these letters. How do you choose the ones that you decide to respond to? Because from what I've read, it seems like thousands of people write in asking for help.
I do have thousands of letters, and they're so fascinating. They really tell the story of what it means to be human. And what I do is I choose letters based on my own interests, my own curiosities. I also really try to make sure that the column is diverse. I think a lot of people, when they hear that name, Dear Sugar, they think it's going to be a column about romance and love and sex and relationships. And it is that. But it's also everything else. I wanted to write about loss and grief and money and friendship and work and all of the different parts of our lives. I wanted to make it as diverse as we are as a people.
The Rumpus focuses a lot on the quality of writing. Is that something that you pay attention to in terms of the people who write to you as well?
I don't really. But I think inevitably what happens is those letters that are very well written rise to the proverbial top of the pile. Sometimes people will write me letters that are, if they're not so well written, the problem that they're presenting is unclear, or the information they're giving me is contradictory. And so it's really hard to answer that question. And because people are writing to me almost always anonymously, I don't even have so much as an email address that I can say, could you clarify this point? And so people do note the quality of those letters in Tiny Beautiful Things. And it really is you know, that I think that those letters were, I chose them because they were so well written.
When you receive these letters, what's the process? Do you find that you're thinking about them for a while before you can send a response?
I do. Almost all of the letters in Tiny Beautiful Things were written in the middle of the night on a Wednesday night, truly the day before a column went live on the Rumpus. And I broke every rule that I have for myself as a writer and the rules I teach my students. And that is, you know, that writing takes time and that when you write something, you should let it sit there for a while before you, you know, think to publish it. But with Sugar, there was something about that, the passion I felt when writing it, the fact that I had a deadline and that I was always up against it. So these columns, genuinely, I would say 90% of the columns in Tiny Beautiful Things were written in the middle of the night. But that doesn't mean I didn't think about my answer for quite some time. Oftentimes I'll get a letter, I read everything that comes to me, and it's really the ones that sort of stick in my mind that I find myself thinking about when I'm taking a walk or maybe trying to fall off to sleep and not being able to because I'm wrestling with, you know, what am I going to say? Even in the first column in the book, there's a column called Like an Iron Bell. I even write, what am I going to say to this man, Johnny, who's written to me? It really haunted me, as many of the letters did.
Can you describe what Johnny's question was?
Johnny had been married for 20-some years and had recently been divorced. And he found himself in love with another woman. And he was excited about this new relationship and wanting to put his, you know, his past relationship behind him. But what he was afraid of is he didn't know how to express his love to this new woman because he felt if he told her he loved her, that this would imply all of these commitments that he wasn't ready to make. So he was essentially afraid of saying, I love you. And in that letter, I told him that he gets to define the terms. He gets to define what love means in different contexts with different women. And what was so interesting on my tour, I've been traveling the nation these last few weeks talking about Tiny Beautiful Things. And at one of my signings, a man came up to me and said, I'm Johnny. And I said, oh, nice to meet you. And he said, no, I'm Johnny. And he was standing there with his girlfriend, the woman he wrote to me about.
Oh, my goodness.
2 years ago. And they told me that I had saved their relationship.
What is that like? That's a very different kind of writing than the writing most people do, where you can see the person who you've responded to walk up to you at a book signing.
It's astounding. And I should say that was only the first of, I've had many experiences like that on my book tour where I meet the letter writers. They come up and whisper, I'm the responsible one, or I'm the, you know, this or that. And it's profoundly moving to me. And deeply gratifying. I've always wanted to help people and to reach people and to, in some way, you know, change people's hearts or minds through my writing. And I never set about that in literary work, like in Wild or my first book, Torch. You know, you can't be so direct. There isn't that direct address. You're not overtly speaking to the reader. And in Sugar, I really am saying to a real person who has written to me, here's what I think about your problem. And so there's a very powerful connection that I have to the readers. It's tremendously moving.
We don't see this in the book, but on the Rumpus, there will be the question, there will be your response, and then all of the other readers come in and start responding too. What is it like to share both the story that you're responding to and your own response, and then see all of these different points of view show up on the website?
It's fascinating. A whole community has been built around the Dear Sugar column. I call it Sugarland because there really is, and people have connected with each other through that. They've continued the conversation. They've deepened the inquiry beyond the exchange that I and a letter writer have. And I think that, you know, what has happened with the Dear Sugar column defies all of those things that many of us think about what happens on the internet.
Yes, the internet can be notorious for people being very mean to each other.
Very ugly. That's right. And what you'll find on the Rumpus is that's not how it works there. And I think part of it, you know, one of the biggest risks I've ever taken as a writer was writing this column. And more importantly, writing this column with all of my heart and sincerity on display. I wasn't going to go in there and be snarky and be cutting and be cute. You know, I wanted to really be very sincere in my answers to people. And what I was afraid of is that people would make fun of me for that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, snarky does really well on the internet and it's very entertaining. But what happened is when I was sincere, people were sincere back. Mm-hmm. And it opened up this whole and very surprising dialogue, if you will, online.
I can understand that fear because we live in a culture where genuine emotion is something that often gets covered by snark.
That's right.
And what you are doing here is opening that up.
Thank you.
Where does the title come from, Tiny Beautiful Things?
Tiny Beautiful Things is that there's a column in the book. It's the last column in the book. And I wrote it about a year and a half ago in response to a young woman who was 22. She asked me what I would tell my 22-year-old self. And so it's really this column that I'm addressing myself, saying all of the things that I wish I had known then. And that very particular phrase, Tiny Beautiful Things, comes from an experience I had when I was 24 and 25. I was really at what I think of as the darkest time of my life, the most difficult time. My mother had died young at 45 of cancer. It was the greatest loss of my life. And I'd found myself really tangled up in a bad place, involved with heroin and just feeling really alone and worthless. And I was riding the bus, and a little girl got on the bus carrying two balloons, and she tried to hand me one, but I wouldn't take it. And in Tiny Beautiful Things, I tell myself, take that tiny beautiful thing. You do have a right to it, even though you don't think you do. And so that tiny beautiful thing is that purple balloon.
There's also a poignancy that this young woman was 22, which that was the year that your mother died, was when
That's
you were
right.
22 also.
That's right.
When you hear these letters and feel them, do you, this is a complicated question, but it's hard sometimes to hear other people's pain and not feel it in yourself. How do you deal with getting all of this pain all the time through the mail?
I really feel it in myself. I really do. I don't think that you could do this job if you didn't.
You could do the snarky part, probably.
You could do the snarky
part,
but
not the genuine
you couldn't do
part.
You know, what I do is I honestly, I think that my ability to feel other people's pain is what does allow me to, I guess, come up with the answers that I write, because I let it live in me. And that process that I just described, where I write it in one, you know, passionate night, but it sits in me for sometimes weeks before that, is it's my way of almost processing their pain and sort of filtering, you know, through what are the truths that we can draw from this situation? What are the places that we can look deeper for change? And, you know, because I think that there aren't simple answers to the complex questions. And so in my column, what I do is I try to answer as complexly as I've been asked.
I'm speaking with Cheryl Strayed about her new book, Tiny Beautiful Things, Advice on Love and Life from Dear Sugar. It's published by Vintage, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Cheryl Strayed about her book, Tiny Beautiful Things from Vintage. Cheryl, as Dear Sugar, you initially were a fan of this advice column. You were not the first Sugar. What was it that drew you to the column as a reader first?
Well, I really just happened upon it. The Rumpus had been founded back in 2009, early 2009, and I heard about it somehow through the literary circles I'm in, and I went and clicked on over, and I saw that they had an advice column, which I thought was kind of interesting. And immediately I recognized the prose was that of a writer that I just loved to read. I didn't know who it was. I didn't know if it was a man or a woman, but I was just drawn to the quality of the writing. It was funny. It was full of all kinds of wit and intelligence. And so I would go back to the Rumpus for the purpose of reading this Dear Sugar column. But what was maddening is there was no schedule. You know, it would be up only intermittently. And so I did write Dear Sugar a letter, an email. I just said, I don't know who you are, but I think you're a great writer. And I signed my name. Well, months passed. I never heard from this Sugar person. And I got an email one day from my friend, the writer Steve Almond. And he said, Cheryl, It's me writing that Dear Sugar
column. So this was someone you knew, but you hadn't known that he was doing this.
That's right. I didn't know he was Sugar. And so he said, Cheryl, it's me who's been writing this column, and I'm not really interested in it anymore, and it doesn't really have much of a following, and it doesn't pay anything. Would you like to take over?
That's a really wonderful sort of seduction into this. It's like, it doesn't pay and nobody pays attention to it, but would
That's
you
right.
like to do this?
It's par for my course. That's my kind of job. So I, of course, immediately signed on. And what I knew from the start is, you know, I wasn't going to be able to be Steve Almond. I could only be Cheryl Strayed. And, you know, I have so much admiration for Steve that I was nervous about that. I wasn't, you know, as funny on the page or, you know, those sorts of things. I was going to have to bring to the column what I had. And so I said about it. At the time, he had four letters to hand over to me. And those are the first letters I answered in the column.
As you figured out the voice that you would have, you said you wanted it to be Cheryl, but did you create a kind of character for Cheryl, for Sugar, or was this really from you?
Well, at first, I leaned rather hard into this, not so much being a character, but rather a persona.
I say
in the column at one point that Sugar is sort of like me after like a glass and a half of wine, you know, just a slightly sassier sister of, you know, Cheryl. But what happened is over time, so at first I was leaning into that and calling people, you know, I call my readers Sweet Pea and I...
Things you do in regular life?
Right, I do in regular life. I'm always calling people honey and Sweet Pea. And that's... how that rose very genuinely out of my own life and the way I talk. But I don't do that in my other writing. I don't call people Sweet Pea in my writing as Cheryl. But Sugar seemed like the perfect place to put that kind of language. And over time, though, pretty quickly, I pulled back from that persona. If you went back and read the columns in chronological order, I think you would see that earlier on, I'm leaning into that persona, and then it starts to slowly fall away. And really, until Sugar now is just merged with Cheryl. And so many people, by the time, you know, I revealed my identity on Valentine's Day of this year, and by then hundreds of people had figured out it was me.
Had been guessing that this is who you were. That's interesting.
Based on when they had read my work, they would recognize the style and the voice.
How has writing as Sugar affected the other writing that you do, the fiction and the nonfiction?
It's been so informative to me. I think that, you know, the thing I brought most to this column is really my skills, are really my skills as a writer, particularly a fiction writer. You have to understand human motivation and desire and the things we say and don't say, and the things that we own up to and refuse to. And those are the murky waters that I've always, you know, dug into as a fiction writer. And so as Sugar, I'm being presented with a very nonfiction version of that. People are coming to me and telling me their deepest secrets and struggles and sorrows. And so it's confirmed everything I always suspected about the human condition. And it's also given me a lot more... sort of, I guess, things to think about when it comes to the human experience. And what's been striking is how much everyone needs to be loved and how alone everyone feels at one time or another, and how we all conceive of ourselves in some ways as the outsider, whether it be, you know, the friends who didn't greet you as warmly as you hoped they would, or the love that you feel is not reciprocated. There are always these struggles, I think, to be loved. And that has been so striking to me in the letters that I've received. We all want that. We all want to be validated.
And I think, you know, radio is my business, but I think to be listened to be heard is such a powerful need also, that when people feel that someone's listened to them, even if you might disagree, there's such power in knowing that you've been heard.
I think that's really true. I did this one column on Thanksgiving. Instead of me writing a column, what I decided to do was ask my readers to send me letters of gratitude, and not thanking me, but rather,
right,
you know, expressing gratitude that they had for something in their lives. And I just received, you know, thousands of them, and I chose many dozens and dozens to publish on The Rumpus. And it was really one of the most moving columns I've ever published, and I didn't write it. It was people expressing their gratitude. And I think that you're right. They felt heard by being able to say thank you and have it there on that computer screen for everyone to read.
Are there things that still surprise you in the letters that you receive? I mean, that you talked about the kind of undercurrent of the need for love, which I totally agree with. Are there things that come through that you say, I hadn't thought about it in this way?
Yes, but it is more unique to get that. Usually, you know, I can put the letters into maybe six piles. You know, it turns out we all have about six problems.
And it just depends. We might have all six at once or maybe in varying degrees.
Exactly. And then sometimes just again and again, you know. But I think that every once in a while one comes over, you know, I receive one and I think, oh, okay, this is not something I've thought about before or answered before. And I think that you know, we get into when people are telling about a very particular experience, like some of the letters I've written about, you know, there's this one called Icky Thoughts Turn Me On. This woman is writing about her sexual fantasies and she feels like she's just so alone.
She's the only one in the world. Right.
And I'm like, no, you know, about a third of the readers have the same fantasy probably. So a lot of it is that too. People write to me thinking that they're going to be the weird letter. And in fact, they're in one of those six piles.
Are there ever letters that may be beautifully written, but you think, I'm not going to answer this?
Well, I have a lot of letters that really repeat other questions before, that I feel like I already have answered this, and I don't have anything new to say about it. I would say that a huge number of letters I have are from young people who've had their hearts broken for the very first time, and they're sure that they can't go on. They're sure that they're going to die of heartbreak. And that's a challenging letter to answer, because the answer is so short and simple and sweet, and that's, you're going to be okay. Just trust me, you're really going to be okay. But, you know, so I haven't answered a lot of those, but it is really a sort of fascinating study to see, too, going back to people being heard, that even if I have answered a question before, they want me to answer their question.
Because they may not have heard the resonance themselves
right.
in what other people have written
yeah.
to you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is something you'll continue? Are you finding that it's still feeding you enough to want to keep going as Sugar?
Yes, I will continue the column. I think it will now be a more occasional column. Obviously, I've been very busy promoting Wild since it came out in March and Tiny Beautiful Things Now. And so I haven't been writing the column much since then. I've just written a couple columns. But I do want to go back to it. It is something that's very interesting and rewarding to me as a writer. But I think I'm going to shift into a more, every once in a while, there will be a Dear Sugar column mode. But, you know, I think that as long as it's interesting to me, I'll keep doing it. And I can't imagine that it would ever stop being interesting.
As a advice columnist, you do something that I haven't seen very many other places, and that is you share your own stories of your own life. So many columns you go to and it takes a kind of omniscient, yes, I know what this is and I'm going to tell you how it goes. And for you, it's almost as if you're meeting the vulnerability of the reader with a vulnerability of your own. Was that intentional? Was that something that you knew from the beginning you wanted to do?
I didn't know that consciously, no. But it doesn't surprise me that that's the direction I went. Because I think that, to me, in my own problems, when I've needed my own consolation, it's really been the stories of other writers, the poems of other poets, who have been a great comfort to me. Them telling me their experience of loss or love or any of those things. And so I thought, well, that's what I got from those writers, so why don't I give it to others? And so I really do bring that kind of storyteller to bear on this column. And so it was a very natural thing for me to reach in the direction of my own stories.
And I can feel the stories of others in this book, too, in that, and it's appropriate for a website that's a literary website. You do draw on those poets and other writers to say, this is you're not the only one, but people have been thinking about this for centuries.
Right. I often pull them in. Adrian Rich and Thomas Tranströmer, and I've named numerous other writers in the course of answering my questions.
We just have a moment left, but how does your family, I know you're a mother, you have small children, you're married, how has this affected the way that you look at your own kids and the things that they wrestle with? I mean, they're probably little and not wrestling with these big questions, but has it affected you as a mother?
I think that, like I said, that those letters have really just deepened my sense of what it means to be human. They've confirmed everything I sort of suspected. And so I bring that into everything in my life, my writing as well as my mothering.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Cheryl Strayed about her book, Tiny Beautiful Things from Vintage.